Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hey, Diane, how you doing?
I am well. How are you?
I'm suffering a little cycling withdrawal, not from the weather, just from holiday crush.
Yeah, it seems like the closer we get to the holidays, the less festive I am.
I'm booked solid.
Really?
I need a holiday to have a holiday.
Yeah, that's what they say about vacations. I need a vacation from my vacation.
Exactly.
Well, there might be some axiom that clears up this whole idea of holidays taking up half of our lives. It's pretty oppressive. At least I'm not doing the shopping thing much.
There you go.
Yeah. So on a happy note, this is pretty cool. Even though Greg is of the I don't believe in milestones, the Outspoken Cyclist reached 1,000 fans on Facebook this week.
Wow.
And then went over by 5.
Huh.
Yeah. So Kathy from Florida posted a big smiley face when she realized she was the one who hit the 1,000. It was cute. So thanks to Kathy and all the other Facebook fans. I really do appreciate all the people who listen and all the comments, suggestions, and likes. We get a lot of suggestions for guests from people on Facebook. It's interesting. There have also been some interesting, though not unexpected, developments on the Lance Armstrong front this week. Not the least of which is the possibility that triple damages might be expected if fraud is proven as Floyd Landis's whistleblower case continues to move forward. Did you read about this?
I saw the headline and I kind of just
blew it off.
Moved past it.
Move on.
I've reached saturation on this, but I'm listening to you.
Okay, thanks. The USPS and the Department of Justice evidently can, under the whistleblower law, intervene in Mr. Landis's suit and pursue the case on its own behalf. However, damages, which they're talking like $30 million if fraud is proven because of the treble, you know, the way they would have to pay out, mm-hmm. It might be mitigated. There's some argument that says that the USPS received, quote, outsized publicity, reducing the otherwise multi-million dollar amount in damages. So because of all the publicity Postal Service got during the time that Lance Armstrong was actually racing and allegedly winning, they did well, so they may not be able to get the full gazillion dollar outcome. Regardless, the suit at its best is ugly. The article is Feds Ponder Joining Suit Against Armstrong, detailed in the Wall Street Journal on December 10th. It was written by Reed Albergotti.
Do they have to algebraically sum the negative publicity and the positive publicity, then come up with a net negative or positive before they can figure out whether USPS was ultimately, helped or harmed?
My math ain't good enough to, cull all of the negative and positive and put it into, you could shake it up in a bag and see what comes out, what sinks to the bottom or rises.
Divide by the square root of the gradient up Alpe d'Huez, and I think you have your answer.
That somebody's going to get something or not. Let's move on, shall we? It's been a while since we talked with a custom frame builder. This week, we have the pleasure of speaking with a 4 years in a row award-winning craftsman. Dave Wages, who's the owner of Ellis Cycles in Waterford, Wisconsin, builds elegant classic bikes that incorporate some unique features such as his signature stainless steel dropouts. Dave's going to talk to us about his history, his philosophy, and what he thinks an aspiring frame builder might want to consider before hanging out a shingle. Dave has some amazing credentials. We'll also reach across the ocean to speak with another Dave, this time Dave Smith. Dave Smith is a coach with a sports science background and has, and I will quote him, quote, annoyed numerous people with his effective yet quirky and counterintuitive approach to enhancing performance, end quote. Even though he makes a bit of fun of himself, he's coached Olympians as well as national and world champion riders. He also was just brought on by our friend Leslie Cohen at Cyclismus as the Global Performance Manager, which is short for, everything from marketing to product reviews. We'll let him fill us in on that a little bit later in the show. So it's an all Dave show this evening. And although we'll have a couple of more gift ideas and some news a bit later in the show, let's begin by welcoming Dave Wages from Ellis Cycles to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening, Dave.
Well, thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. We finally caught up.
Yeah, definitely.
For those who aren't familiar with you or your company, Ellis Cycles, I'd like to begin with your little story about your silver Raleigh record 10-speed.
Okay.
Where did you grow up, and how did this bike start you on sort of your path to where you are today?
Well, I grew up in upstate New York. And we started out kind of in the suburbs. And just about the time I was old enough to really kind of get around on my bike and go anywhere in the suburbs, we moved out to the country. So way out in the middle of nowhere, last house on a dead-end road. And I had a little, like, single-speed Schwinn, and that thing just wasn't cutting it. Where I grew up, it's a little town called Duanesburg, really hilly around there. So you're not getting very far with a single-speed. So when I was 12, my folks got me a 10-speed Raleigh record. I'm sure hundreds of other kids have a similar experience. And that bike just kind of opened up a whole new world. And you know, I could finally kind of get farther away from home and go farther afield and, you know, started, you know, what got me hooked on bikes.
Well, and you started sort of like sweeping bike shops. I mean, you actually did start as a youngster in a bike shop and moved your way up. You paid your dues along the way. So when did you actually start working in the first bike shop?
The first bike shop, I think I was a junior in high school, and it was the Bike, Golf, and Ski Warehouse, which gives you an idea of kind of the broad range of bikes. And I built a lot of little kids' bikes, and it was, you know, not very glamorous, but it got my foot in the door, and surprisingly, I stuck with it.
And that's what's interesting. It didn't matter. You know, you have the bike gene. We decided that people like you and me somehow got a bicycle gene in our DNA. So in 1994, you received a call that would take you to, at that time, where was it? The Serrata factory. Was it in Glens Falls then?
It was in Glens Falls,
yeah.
We were in a big old paper bag factory up there.
Yep.
And the shop, yeah.
And the two big influences were Dave Kirk and Kelly Bedford. So tell us a little bit about your experience at Serrata, because, you know, that's the big time.
Yeah, I mean, when I initially got the job there, it was actually through a friend of mine that I worked with at that first shop. And he worked in the shipping department, so, I mean, even at Serrata, I kind of came in on the very ground floor. I worked in the shipping department, so I didn't just walk in and they started showing me how to braze the first day. I probably packed, you know, a few thousand bikes into boxes with bubble wrap, and, you know, I used to paint the little engravings in on the Serrata forks and bridges and that kind of thing. So, you know, that's kind of how I got my foot in the door, and I did that for probably like 3 years, and, you know, over that time, I expressed some interest with Dave and Kelly, and, you know, they showed me a little bit of the basics. You know, I stayed after work, and they showed me kind of how to turn the torch on and off and how to melt some brass. And then from there, it was just me staying after and just practicing. And there was, you know, lots of, you know, cut-off material and just waste material that I could just practice with and just kind of you know, hone the skills kind of slowly over time and just kind of work on little projects. And one of the first things I ever built there was a set of bar ends that I still have.
No kidding.
Yeah, it was you know, it's kind of a neat little project because it's fairly simple. There isn't a lot to it, you know, a couple little pinch barrels and, you know, clamp material and then an extension. But it was a cool way to build something that you could actually use. And you'd be like, hey, you know, I actually built these things that are on my bike instead of just raising stuff and then throwing in the trash bin. So
sure,
yeah, it was pretty cool.
That is cool, and you still have them, huh?
Yep,
that's good too. You made a comment about, and I'm going to quote you, that the subtle differences that separate a good frame from an exceptional one. What do you mean by that? Elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, I think this is, you know, when I did finally, start building frames at Cerata, it's a bike factory. So, you know, we're building bikes. We're trying to build a really high-quality product, but at the same time, you know, there's kind of a minimum standard. And if you want to, you can just go through the day and build the bikes to the minimum standard. And they're like, well, they're fine. There's nothing wrong with them. But I think this is kind of where Dave Kirk and I kind of connected. You know, I think he saw something in me that, you know, I think like you're saying, the bike gene maybe, is that, you know, I really wanted to build special bikes, you know, and do as good a bike as I could possibly do. And, you know, he kind of pulled me aside and really worked with me kind of one-on-one and showed me, you know, just, you know, here's what you need to do to get the bike through quality control, and here's what you need to do if you want this bike to look, you know, like somebody really cared. I guess it's hard to, you know, kind of quantify that, but even in my years working at Waterford, I used to do a lot of the restoration work there, so I would see bikes come back from, you know, all through the eras from Paramount, and it wasn't that hard, especially when the paint is off of them, to see, like, you know, here was a bike that was built on Friday when they were trying to get the last, you know, last three bikes out, and here was one that was built by somebody who was really, you know, put the time into it, and, you know, it can be subtle, and sometimes it can be really obvious.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dave Wages. He is the proprietor of Ellis Cycles up in Waterford, Wisconsin. And as a matter of fact, that's where we're going to head right now. So you left Cerata to go to Waterford. In fact, I happen to know where one of your bikes is because it happens to be at our house. At Waterford, you built Brian's frame.
Mm-hmm.
And so what was it that you wanted from Waterford that you weren't getting at Cerata?
I guess there was a couple of things that influenced my move from Cerata. I think there was a certain point that I got to at Cerata where I felt like no matter how much I did, I kind of topped out. Like I was probably going to be doing the same thing for years. And, you know, at that point, the point when I made this move was the year 2000, which I guess probably other people had this, you know, where they were just like, it's the year 2000, I need to do something different with my life. And I was 28 years old, and I'm like, what else is out there? You know, I'd never lived anywhere else but New York. So I looked around, and, you know, Waterford was one of the only other shops that was doing, you know, production brazed frames out there. So I called them and, you know, asked them if they would be interested in me, and they were, and I was interested in them. I thought, you know, they did a lot of work with stainless steel lugs, or at least some work with stainless steel lugs, which interested me, and they're a little bit different than Cerata. They did a lot of silver brazing as opposed to brass brazing, so, you know, it just seemed like, you know, what I needed to do in my life, and it worked out well that Waterford needed somebody, and were looking for somebody like me, so... I guess, you know, kind of a interesting confluence there.
And then how much time did you spend at Waterford?
8 years from
wow.
2000 to 2008, yeah. And one of the cool things, like you mentioned, that with Brian's frame is that I got to stamp every single Waterford that I built with my initials. So if folks out there have a lugged Waterford that was built between 2000 and 2008, and you flip it over and look kind of behind the plastic bottom bracket cable guide, and there's a DW, then I built that frame.
That's cool.
It's really cool. You know, at Cerata, we didn't have any way to really identify that. And I was a little surprised when that Waterford did that, but it's really neat to have that connection with folks. And I met lots and lots of people who, you know, I've told that to, and then they've done that, and they're like, oh, man, you know, and you have this, you have a connection with those folks, and it's really cool, and I'm glad Waterford let me do that.
Yeah, that is cool. So then in 2008, you decided to move out on your own and form Ellis Cycles. Just real quick, tell us how you came up with the name Ellis.
Well, Ellis is my middle name, and, you know, obviously my last name, Wages, is a bit of an unusual name. There's certainly some puns and plays on words and stuff you could do with that. So
yeah, you think?
It seems like a little more of a natural for a bike brand name. And it's my great grandmother's maiden name. It's a family name. So it just seemed like a better fit.
Yeah, it looks nice on the down tube.
Yeah, I think it does.
Exactly. So I sort of want to talk a little bit about the bikes that you do make. You only work in steel. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And do you only offer lugged frames?
No, I'll do fillet braced frames as well. It depends. And then I'll do some frames that are like a combination of lug and fillet, which is technically, I guess you'd call it bilaminate.
Okay.
At Dorado, we used to call them half lugs. But if you call it bilaminate, you can charge more.
Aha, I see. I see. Do you make your own forks?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, see, that's a real frame builder, I think. I shouldn't really, you know, like, diss somebody who doesn't make forks, but I know that forks are so important, and a lot of people don't give enough credit to the frame builders who do build their own forks because it's like a complete frame that way.
Yeah, I think, the fork does at least as much as the frame to affect the handling of the bike. And if people have seen my frames, they've seen that the forks have kind of a distinctive rake to them. It's a fairly small radius rake. And I spent a bunch of years building forks a lot of different ways, and I've tried it just about every kind of blade out there, and I really feel like they balance the bike as much as anything.
So do you have a favorite type of frame that you build? I know you build more than just racing frames and touring frames. And do you have a favorite type of frame?
No, a favorite is kind of tough. I guess just from an aesthetic standpoint, I always have liked building track frames just because they're very minimal. There's not a lot of cables that are going to cover up the work that you put into it. But, the reality is, I don't build a lot of track frames, and it doesn't make me like the other frames that I build any less,
Okay.
I guess if that's a reasonable answer.
Yeah, they're all reasonable answers. There are no wrong answers here, Dave. None
right.
at all. So let's come down to the nitty-gritty. What makes an Ellis an Ellis? Because, for example, you have a very distinctive rear dropout. That,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think anybody who sees one would say it wasn't your frame. So what other kinds of things do you think you do that might make a frame more yours? And you just suggested that maybe the rake on your forks might be one thing. But what else?
I think, the people that have, in some of the frames that I've brought to the hand-built show and some of the models that I do, like the Modern Classic.
Tell us about the Modern Classic. That's a cool bike.
The Modern Classic is something I brought to, the first one I built was in 2009 for the hand-built show. And it has stainless steel rear end, and the sheath phase are kind of like a little sleeved unit, so it makes a really nice mask line for the transition from, stainless to paint. And then what I had been doing is chrome forks, but just recently I started building stainless steel forks because I can get stainless fork blades, which is nice. Chrome still, there's some issues with that.
Sure.
But aesthetically, the bike has, it has that look of like a 70s, 80s kind of Italian race bike with, where they just had dots of chrome and chrome lugs. And what I'm trying to do is pull that aesthetic, which is what I loved, and that's, the time when I kind of came into cycling and got me really excited. But yet, I'm not just making replicas of those old bikes. I'm building it with the most modern, stainless tubing or the most modern high-strength tubes for the main tubes and stainless lugs. And, so you're getting the best, you're getting the aesthetics that I really loved and I think a lot of other people really can relate to. But yeah, with the nicest, new materials, and I think it's the best of both worlds. And I think I do that even on the bikes that don't have a lot of stainless. It's kind of that, a classic look to it, but blended with, modern lugs, threadless steers. I do most of my bikes now with inch and eighth steers, so I'm not, like, you know, tying you into, you know, old one-inch steers and having to use shims and all that kind of thing. So really trying to get the best of the classic look and modern materials.
I'd like to ask one more question about the modern classic, and that is that a good selling frame for you?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When I first built it, you know, it has probably every, you know, option or bell and whistle that I offer.
Right.
And, you know, I built it as a show bike, obviously. It's an attention-getting bike. And I priced it basically just saying, you know, hey, this thing takes a ton of work, and this is what I need to get. And, you know, it is a pretty good swing bike. I probably build, you know, for every four bikes I build, one of them is a modern classic.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. That's like a 20 to 25% of your bikes. How many bikes are you building a year? Approximately.
It depends, you know, on what they are. If there's a lot of modern classic or stainless bikes, they take longer. But
sure.
Probably 20, 25 frames a year.
So here's something that you aren't going to say, but I'm going to say it for you, and that is that you have won awards 4 years in a row at the handmade shows.
Yes, I've been really, I guess, I don't know, flattered or you know, really, you know, pleased that people have reacted to this stuff and really like it. And I think there's been a lot of controversy about the awards at NAB, so I know there are plenty of other bikes that could have won those awards, but I'm certainly, you know, pleased that people have liked my stuff, and it, you know, it's gone that way for me.
So I have one last question before I let you go and probably go have dinner. What would you offer as advice to an aspiring frame builder? Just if you were to give somebody one solid piece of advice, what would it be?
Ooh. You know, it's tough to limit that to one piece of advice. I feel like, you know, and I've said this to other folks, I feel like I was kind of the tail end of an era where, you know, you could work in a production shop and learn the craft in a production shop and then go out on your own. It's like those opportunities are just really, really hard to find if they exist at all. So, you know, to become a frame builder now, you know, and go and take a class and maybe build one or two frames and then try and basically build from there. It's not an easy gig. I mean, I guess you've got to be prepared for an uphill battle. But you know, stick with it and, you know, build a lot of bikes for yourself and see what works and what doesn't, and you know, hang in there, I guess.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. One that I had not thought of until now, and that is that you had that option with Serrata and with Waterford, and those shops are not around for people to hang out with. Like the Bill Boston isn't there looking for people. You know, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, like what I look at is, you know, when I started at Serrata and just doing brazing, you know, I brazed probably, you know, a few hundred sets of chainstays before, you know, just the dropout to the chainstay. Just
sure.
Like one after another, and it's like, you know, your learning curve goes up, you know, it's really steep there, especially when you can do the same thing over and over again and see, like, hey, this really worked well this time, and, you know, even from one day to the next, you can go, okay, today it really worked well, and then, like, here's what I need to do tomorrow. But, you know, if you're doing it in your garage and you build one set of chainstays every 2 months, you know, it's hard to even remember, like, what did I do last time where it worked really good?
Yeah, that's because, really interesting.
Well, I mean, I really do feel blessed, you know, to have worked with guys like Dave Kirk and Kelly Bedford, who I could just walk up to and go, like, hey, you know, here's what happened. Like, what do you think went wrong here? And to just, you know, ask somebody who has, you know, 20, 30 years of experience, much less to be able to just do it over and over and have the repetition. So, yeah, I feel really blessed to have had that opportunity.
So are you going to be bringing something to NABS this year? Are you going to go to Denver?
I'm definitely going to Denver. I'm still trying to nail down exactly what bikes are going to be in the show. So
okay.
We'll see.
I guess it is a wait and see, and I'll see you there.
Definitely.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me this evening, Dave, and I wish you a happy holidays.
You too.
And I'll see you in February. I just made my plane reservation, so I will definitely see you in Denver.
All right.
All right. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Dave Wages is the proprietor of Ellis Cycles in Waterford, Wisconsin.
Pretty bikes, aren't they?
They are.
Yeah.
There's more than one bike maker in the town of Waterford. Who knew?
Who knew?
I didn't know.
That's exactly right. I've seen his frames. They are beautiful. Brian says they're exquisite, that he's paid his dues. You know, mm-hmm. He spent all those years working at Cerata, and then 8 years at Waterford. I didn't even ask him, I don't think, how many years he spent at Cerata.
You can certainly say he learned from the best,
yes.
Or some of the best,
exactly.
At least.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, you know, Mark at Waterford is an excellent engineer and frame builder, too. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the best,
yes.
We always like to say that the best is yet to come. So we'll let you be the judge of that after we take a short break here and come back with some news and another interview with
Dave Smith
of Flow.
You went and looked at his website. I know. It's fffflow.com.
All right. Right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Confusion ever someone or have sudden...
Have you ever had sudden confusion, trouble speaking, or understanding someone?
It could be one of the five signs of stroke.
Sudden weakness or numbness of the face, arm, or leg.
Sudden trouble with vision in one or both eyes.
Suddenly having trouble walking or difficulty with balance.
Or a sudden intense headache that comes out of nowhere.
Don't wait. Call 911 immediately.
Time lost is brain lost.
Find out more at powertoendstroke.org. Brought to you by the American Heart Association, American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and let's squeeze a little news in here before we move on to our next guest.
Well, our first piece of news is sad. Alex Moulton passed away at the age of 92, and if you know anything about small-wheeled suspension bikes, he'd a man. Dr. Moulton contributed very greatly to the transportation industry as a whole, not just to bicycling. Here is the statement from the Moulton website. It is with great sorrow that Sean Moulton and the Moulton Bicycle Company announced the news that Dr. Alexander Eric Moulton, CBE, distinguished engineer and inventor, passed away peacefully in the company of his family and staff on Sunday evening, 9 December 2012, at the age of 92. Dr. Moulton was an inspiration for generations of engineers, designers, and inventors. Educated at Marlborough and Cambridge, Alex Moulton worked at Bristol Aeroplanes as assistant to Sir Roy Fedden during World War II. He joined Bradford on Avon Rubber Manufacturers, Spencer Moulton, in 1945, leading a new research team. His collaboration with Sir Alec, I think it's Isigonis, resulted in Moulton suspension, including hydroplastic and hydrogas systems, being employed in over 12 million British cars, from the original Mini to the MGF. Dr. Moulton was also famous for his revolutionary small-wheeled full-suspension Moulton bicycle, very popular in the 1960s, and still built by hand in Bradford-on-Avon by a loyal team of engineers, technicians, and craftsmen. Yeah, so it kind of sad, but, you know, 92, he was okay.
And he accomplished so much.
Oh, yeah. Obviously, he was brilliant. It wasn't just about bicycles, that's for sure.
Yeah.
As long as we're talking about inventors and inventions, this was announced this week. I can remember 3 speeds, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11 speed drivetrains. Are you ready for 12 speed?
I'm listening.
How about 12 speed wireless? From Taizo Bike in Italy comes a radio or Bluetooth wireless 12-speed group set that includes the rear derailleur, front derailleur, cassette shifters, and the main control center. It's said to be compatible with Campy 10 or 11, SRAM 10, or Shimano 10 or 11, but no pricing has been announced. There's a cute little video of it. If you type in Taizo, it's T-I-S-O.
Okay.
I'm telling you, a guy's standing like 10 feet away with a little, like a remote control, just shifting the bike. It's pretty cool. What can I tell you? But 12 speed, it's sort of like, yeah, why? Do you really need another gear back there? I don't know. You know, I'm a big believer in electronic, but this is going to be interesting.
Wouldn't wireless be vulnerable in a race situation? Someone might, have a remote that could
jam your system?
Or could shift your bike for you.
Well, you know.
As you're going by, a spectator might, you know, just... You know.
Zap your bike and suddenly you're in a 5311 when you're going uphill?
Exactly.
I see. What an interesting concept.
Well, hopefully they've got the digital security codes worked out, like your garage door opener, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. This was announced on Thursday, December 13th. Adventure Cycling honors its 2012 Bicycle Travel Award winners. So every year they come out with, I think they have four categories, but the first one was the one that really interested me. This comes from Missoula, Montana. Adventure Cycling Association, North America's largest cycling membership organization, is pleased to announce the winners of its 2012 Bicycle Travel Awards. The 2012 June Curry Trail Angel Award goes to Byron Seeley, Kelly White, and Vicky Howell of Jeffrey City, Wyoming. Located in a ghost town halfway between Rawlins and Lander on the Trans-America Trail, these three provide resources and shelter to cyclists where none otherwise exist. As their nominator explained, quote, Byron and Kelly run Monk King Bird Pottery in an abandoned gas station across from the Split Rock Cafe, which is Vicky's place. Since the only motel in Jeffrey City closed in 2009, Byron and Kelly have graciously offered a place to camp or accommodations in their trailer or on the floor of their studio to many traveling cyclists, including me, meaning the nominator. Jeffrey City is a wild place with big storms, rattlesnakes, clouds of mosquitoes, and miles of sagebrush. The hospitality of Byron, the Mad Potter, Kelly, and Vicky is a true legend of the Trans Am. So, tip of the helmet to all three of them. I'm not sure I'm going to go through Jeffrey City, Wyoming anytime soon, but at least we know there's a place to stay. If you're interested in seeing what the other awards are, you can go to adventurecycling.org/news, and you'll find it. I thought that was kind of nice. There are a couple others, too. You know, I didn't start the news with a doping story this week. And while this doesn't qualify exactly, I don't think, as beating a dead horse, do you know who Alexei Graywall is?
I've heard the name, yeah.
Okay. Well, he is one of the fallen soldiers who's actually rethinking cycling and has, in the meantime, found other pursuits. In a blog entry on December 10th, he made an interesting observation that I hadn't heard. Alexei said, quote, it seems it is time to comment on the ethos of the current situation in competitive cycling world, in particular the Lance Armstrong affair, or the end of doping as we knew it. Not to think doping is over, not at all. He goes on to talk about the culture of European racing and doping, and then concludes, none of the recent news about Lance is really new. He did not invent the system. In my first professional season, my team director, Peter Post, made a point of bringing me to the start of one of cycling's most famous races, a race I was not scheduled to race, to lecture me on the importance of doing what the team doctor told me to do, i.e., taking what the team doctor told me to without asking questions. Peter made a point of giving me this lecture in the main hotel lobby, where many of the big teams and most of the UCI officials and media were also staying. He had little or no concern that our conversation was private. No one ever tested positive while on a Panasonic team. Very impressive, all things considered. But today our dark knight is Lance Armstrong, whom I have no hate for, in fact, a sort of respect for. Of course, the evidence is conclusive, but we, and I mean we, which means everyone who knows cycling, has known that of course Lance did it better and more persuasively than anyone else. He perfected the system and in all likelihood never thought himself anything other than the protector of cycling's history, myths, and legends, his own version of a Batman. If you'd like to read the entire entry, it's really, really good. It is available at alexigraywall.biz under the cycle training /blog dropdown.
I have just one very short comment.
Yes.
That I've kind of been percolating over the last couple of weeks.
Okay.
After reading Tyler Hamilton's book, you know, he talks about how if he had the choice between 5 points of hematocrit and 5 pounds lighter,
right,
he would take the 5 pounds any day, you know, because weight is so important.
Right.
And really, while he doped, he also drove his body to extremes in terms of his workout routine and his diet, and the doping aside, unhealthy. a lot of ways. And it just strikes me that professional competitive sports are already so bad for the athlete in a lot of ways. Doping just adds, you know, insult to injury on top of it, that you're going to subject your body to yet more abuse in the name of a paycheck or fame or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess that sums up why I have a hard time following some of these sports, because once you know what they're doing to be competitive, it starts to really bother me that people should have to do that to make a living.
Right.
You know?
Yep, that's true. But Alexa Graywall said it pretty well, I think.
If it was any other occupation, we would have OSHA and the unions.
Oh, really? Right down on it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
because, you know, companies were forcing workers to do all these horrible and nasty things and putting them in dangerous situations. It wouldn't be tolerated. But because it's sport, it's just expected.
I guess. All right. I have two quick gift suggestions.
Okay.
Okay. So last week, remember, we had a nice conversation about power meters with Joel Friel. So this week, I'm going to talk to you about the Stages Cycling Power Meter System. The strain gauge attaches to the left-hand crank arm, adds just 20 grams of additional weight. It's designed for road, tri, mountain, downhill, cross, BMX, and track. It has bilingual communication, so it speaks something other than English. With ANT Plus and Bluetooth smart protocols, needs no magnets for cadence because it's internally sensor-based. You switch out the left-hand crank arm, pair the unit, and go. No magnets, zip ties, or other mounting hardware. It has a one-year warranty with an optional two-year damage protection plan, which I think is a good idea. Downside is you can't really have it yet.
Oh, really?
No. It will be available. They are taking orders. It will be available about the second week of January. We have one on order. Brian saw it at the show and just said he loved it because it was so simple.
Yes.
You didn't have to have a rear wheel. It's not super cheap, but it's like a third of the price of the power tap system.
I checked out their website last week.
Oh, you did?
I was drooling.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can justify that price tag for me personally, but
right.
I think if you want to train with a power meter, that's a pretty interesting way to go.
I think so, too. It's at stagescycling.com. The last one, I asked all the bike dealers, you know, I'm on this e-list with the National Bicycle Dealers Association, and I asked all these bike dealers, I said, come up with a cool gift that you think would, you know, I could talk about on the air. And Dan Schumann from Salem Cycle in Salem, Massachusetts, who's just a really cool guy, he has always great things to say, came up with something called the X-Fire Bike Lane. So it consists of two highly visible red lasers equipped with five extremely bright red LEDs. The lasers make an instant bike lane behind you for safe night riding. It's clear and visible, even under headlights and streetlights. There are two AAA batteries included. It's weatherproof and shockproof. Polycarbonate cover with a universal bracket attachment. And you can either go to your local bike shop or go to xfire.com for more information. It's under $50, so it's not real expensive. But a whole bunch of people came back and said, I've had them in my shop and I can't sell them. But it just sounded like a cool idea, the X-Fire Bike Lane. It actually, like, defines this lane behind you.
What's that website again?
X-Fire, xfire.com.
I don't think that's correct.
Yeah, I saw it earlier.
Hold on, we have a mid-air correction here.
Not EX.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Yeah. All right, maybe I copied it wrong. Worst things have happened.
Okay, the
X-Fire. Oh, gee, the X-Fire.
Hey, precision is important.
Yes, it is when it comes to that stuff.
Yeah, T-H-E-X-F-I-R-E.
Okay, missed the T-H-E.
You know, I've seen pictures of this, but it was more like a prototype or a proposed project.
Evidently, it is real.
All right. So thexfire.com if you're interested in creating your own bike lane in your wake.
Right, exactly. Okay, that's my news.
All right. Where are we going next?
We're going across the ocean. We're going to Staffordshire, England, and we are going to talk with Dave Smith from Flow Functional Fitness. Dave, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Hi, Diane. Thank you for having me. It's a great privilege.
No, the privilege is all mine. So, you know, when Leslie Cohn of Cyclismus introduced us, I caught the sense that this is going to be a fun conversation. Can we begin with your background as a sports science graduate and how that led to your coaching philosophy, which I find very interesting, by the way?
Sure. I mean, somewhat ironically, my sports science background tended to lead me away from relying too much on sports science in coaching. Really, I kind of see that there's a danger in having a dogma based on one particular scientific theory, if you like. So really, whilst you need a scientific background, it's dangerous to just think that science has got all the answers.
So you do have a degree, though, in sports science. What does that mean, then?
Well, essentially, the degree comprised of subjects such as exercise physiology, coaching science, biomechanics, sports psychology.
Okay.
That was a good foundation. But even, you know, whilst doing the degree, I could see that some of the theories, if you like, there were just huge holes in them. But because they were science, everyone was supposed to go along with them.
I see. So how did you become involved with cyclists as opposed to saying, oh, runners or soccer players or any other kind of sports athlete? Although I know you also deal with polo, but that's we'll talk about that later. How was it that cyclists became your focus?
Well, basically, while I was at university, I was playing in the university soccer team. And I got a knee injury, so I couldn't run to stay fit. So I bought a bike, started cycling, then I started racing. And some of the people I was racing with, they knew I was doing a sports science degree, so they asked me to coach them. And it just kind of snowballed from there. Some of the guys I was coaching ended up getting, you know, top fives in mountain bike World Cups and what have you. So really, that's why it was cycling. It was purely through a knee injury.
Huh. Kind of serendipitous.
Yeah.
One of the comments you made is coaching is an artistic lunch. This was a cool comment. You have to think about it. Coaching is an artistic lunch that follows a scientific breakfast, meaning that science is the foundation on which performance can be built via creative thinking, subtractive rather than additive. For example, remove the barriers to improvement before addition of complexity. What kinds of barriers do you find as you begin working with, say, a new client or an athlete?
The type of barriers are as numerous as the type of client, but you know, primarily you would have things like just a busy lifestyle, incomplete knowledge. You know, a lot of times people would read things on the internet, in magazines, they would get lots of conflicting advice. So really, sometimes you have to re-educate. You have to almost, you know, tell them to forget everything they think they know. And also as a coach, that's something I have to constantly do is, you know, look at the information I have and sometimes discard things that you believed had been correct. Another thing is people want to be perfect. You know, they want perfect performances, and nothing is perfect. You know, the most expensive diamond in the world has got flaws in it. So, you know, really I like to have people think about excellent performances rather than perfect performances. Another barrier can just be having lots of negative people around them. So, you know, an athlete can have a goal, they can have a dream, and everyone else is telling them that's crazy and don't be stupid, you can't do that. So, yeah, there are so many possible barriers.
Yeah, that's interesting, though. I get exactly what you're saying. So your website, which is called Flow Functional Fitness, let's just get the functional part out of the way.
The functional side just really addresses the fact that it's got to have a purpose. You know, just riding your bike is not training to be a cyclist. It's training to be good at riding a bike. And in terms of competitive performances, you know, there are hundreds of thousands, millions of people around the world who can ride a bike. So the training has to be functional in that it has to be addressing the demands of your particular challenge.
So the website, Flow Functional Fitness, says that you specialize in making clients leaner, faster, stronger, more energetic, and ultimately happier. So is weight loss a big factor in becoming a better athlete?
I think appropriate weight loss can be. I mean, cycling performance in most events, it's influenced by many factors, and power to weight ratio is certainly one of the more important ones. If you can get a little bit lighter without compromising your health and your fitness, your performance is going to be enhanced. But countering that, you know, you need to take care. Many cyclists in the past have had eating disorders. Disturbingly, I know of some where it started from a coach just making a throwaway comment like, you know, you're too fat to be successful.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's pretty negative.
It's pretty negative. There are a few negative coaches out there. But essentially, yeah, I would say it's not so much a case of weight loss as being essential, but being at the appropriate weight for your events, you know, without compromising your health. Because if you get really low body fat levels, for example, it can compromise your immune system. So yeah, it's important to have a good power to weight ratio, but it's also important to, you know, to address it correctly.
So do you recommend a specific diet for your clients? I assume that each one individually will have some sort of nutritional needs, but are you more along the lines of a vegetarian diet, or do you have a vegan diet, or a pesca, whatever diet, fish diet?
It's hard to say what category I would put it in. I mean, all the clients will have different needs in terms of the type of events that they're focusing on. You know, even individual variation in how they respond to certain foods. I guess my philosophy is really to focus on healthy, fresh, you know, non-processed food. I'm also quite enthusiastic about trying to cut out a lot of grain-based food, and obviously sugar as well.
Yeah.
I think during and after certain training sessions, it's fine to have you know, certain type of carbs, but generally sugar is, I would say, go so far as to say it's pretty toxic in most situations. So, that would be the main thing, is just healthy, fresh, non-processed food.
Okay, that's good. Let's take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with David Smith. He's in Staffordshire, England, and he's talking to us about his coaching philosophy, Flow Functional Fitness, and we're going to also talk about some of the riders he's worked with and about what he's going to be doing coming up in the future. So where do you think, and I know this is sort of one of those comments that you don't want to diss other people, but where do you think coaching techniques fail? What kinds of coaching techniques don't work? Because I know a lot of people use online coaches and all kinds of coaching, and they're not really getting very far. Do you know specifically what fails?
I don't know so much about other methods failing. You know, most methods will work to some extent. If someone rides a bike more, within reason, they're going to become a better cyclist. And certainly I don't have all the answers. As far as remote coaching or online coaching is concerned, I mean, I've had success at the highest level with athletes when I don't even speak the same language. In the days before email, you know, when it was faxes. So I certainly don't think there's necessarily an issue with online or remote coaching.
Okay.
As far as methods that would fail, I think one thing I'm seeing at the moment within cycling is, you know, people who think that just analyzing power data equates to coaching. And, you know, a power meter is just one more tool that a coach can use. But looking at power data shouldn't be confused with actual coaching. You know, coaching it's multidisciplinary. It's the mental aspects. It's nutritional. It's looking at lifestyle choices. You know, there's so much more to coaching than just looking at power data and prescribing, you know, intervals at 300 watts or whatever. And I think that's something that's become pretty prevalent within cycling.
That's an interesting point, because there's been so much talk about power right now, and you're the first one who's actually said, yeah, it's just one little piece of it. And when you, just the way you put it into context, it makes perfect sense that by itself, it doesn't, I mean, yeah, it can tell you some things, but it certainly isn't a full coaching, you know, discipline all the way around.
Yeah. I mean, for example, someone asked me a couple of weeks ago, you know, if they didn't use a power meter, you know, what implications might that have on their performance? And, you know, the honest answer is you may well end up like Philippe Gilbert and win the World Road Championship.
Right.
Or, you know, Thomas Voeckler, who doesn't use a power meter either. So it's just a tool. And, you know, one thing I would say about power, it's very useful to look at the power after a training session. That's probably more beneficial than actually staring at it during the training session.
Got it.
So, you know, base the session on, I suppose, on feel, on how you feel you want to be as a rider in the future. Try and make some efforts like that, and then look at what the power is saying about those efforts afterwards.
Okay, I think that's good advice. Excellent advice. So can we talk about some of the riders you've coached, at least one in particular?
Okay, yeah, we could do that.
Because I know you coached the Great Britain Olympic team back in Atlanta, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And you've also coached David Miller.
Yeah, that's right. In David's, well, going from junior to amateur and then his first year as a professional, I was working with David. And he's a pretty interesting case. He's probably one of the most intelligent people I've coached in any sport. Unusual in that, you know, he had a pretty interesting upbringing, living in Hong Kong. Father was an airline pilot, very well traveled. And, you know, normally you find that if people travel, then they've got a different view of the world. So, yeah, very interesting guy, super intelligent. And, you know, I haven't worked with him for a long time, but, you know, certainly I learned a lot from working with him.
Really? Isn't that nice?
Yeah, I mean,
that you got to learn as much as he got to? That's kind of cool.
I learned from everybody I coach. You know, you pick up so much stuff. You know, even from a recreational rider who wants to ride something like the Étape de Tour, you know, you learn things from everyone. I think if a coach doesn't learn, then they're doing something wrong.
Okay. Now I want to ask you about polo. You know, I said something to Brian, my partner. I said, you know, I don't think of people who ride horses. Now, and we have a friend who trained and raced and jumped horses, and she's now a bike racer and, you know, is doing very well in the senior category. But I don't guess I think of riders on horses playing polo as being athletes, but yet you coach a polo team.
I work with the International Polo Academy, and, you know, throughout the academy, we have experts in horse riding, in playing the game. I focus on the fitness side. And, you know, when I came into it, I certainly didn't know a great deal about polo. But when you analyze the sport, you know, it's pretty hardcore. I would see it as like motocross with hockey sticks. It's very demanding in terms of fitness.
Interesting.
The riders, they're moving, well, we call it through the three planes of motion. So they're leaning forward. They can be leaning to the side at the same time. They can be rotating. So there's a great demand in terms of the musculature. Obviously, the balance. They're riding a horse that's got a brain of its own. And then they're trying to hit a little small ball. So it is pretty demanding.
I guess. Polo's not a big sport here in this country. So I'd like to talk about one last thing before mm-hmm. we end our little conversation, which I wish we had more time. And that is your new job working with Cyclismus, which is here in the States. What are you going to be doing? Because one of the hallmarks of Leslie's band of merry folks is irreverence. I take it you're going to fit right in?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all speak the same language there.
Okay.
And I kind of struggle to see it as a job. I mean, firstly, I think I'm pretty much unemployable. I can't see it as a job. I see it more as just being creative with a group of crazy people, and they're very smart people. They're great to work with. Some of them are almost as funny as me. And, you know, I think cycling of all activities should be fun. So, you know, even when it's a business related to cycling, it should be fun.
What are you going to be doing for Cyclismus? And I take it you're going to be positioned in Europe as opposed to here in the States. So are they expanding? Is that what's going to happen? We're going to expand Cyclismus into Europe?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, I would say I'm probably their UK stroke European human being at the moment.
Okay.
And I think my role really is to act as a link between Cyclismus and, you know, people in the industry and the media. So almost coaching in a sense of, you know, looking at what resources are available and maximizing the performance, communicating, looking at innovative ways of doing business. And, you know, coaching and marketing are actually very similar beasts. They involve very similar thought processes, and so hopefully I'll get to create some pretty goofy content as well for them.
Well, they certainly have some goofy content. It's fun to watch. Well, will you be coming to the States at all?
Yeah, I'd hope so. I used to do a lot of work in the States, and
okay.
It's been too long since I've been there. So, yeah, hopefully I'll get out there.
I'll watch and see what you're going to be doing in Europe for Cyclismus, and keep in touch. And I appreciate you talking to me on the radio this evening.
No, thanks very much, Diane. It's been great.
All right. You have a good night.
You too. Thanks,
all right. Bye-bye.
Dave Smith runs Flow Functional Fitness in Staffordshire, England.
He does indeed.
He joined us via Skype.
We've been chatting on Skype all week. He's hilarious. He sounded really kind of... maybe he was nervous, but I can tell you that he's really, really funny.
Perhaps on his best behavior for, you know,
maybe, because I originally reminded him, you know, I let people know long in advance. Remember, we have our interview this week and blah, 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 blah. And I originally said to him, he said to me, I don't have a date that night. So I said to him this week, I said, are you ready for our interview? He said, I still don't have a date for this week. And he mentioned it a couple of times. I said, oh, come on, a good-looking guy like you. He goes, it's ridiculous, isn't it? he was very funny as we were kind of chatting all week, and he got a little straight on the air.
Watch for his humorous side on Cyclismus.
Absolutely. Then. I think it's going to be hilarious. Along with Leslie, who is just a stitch. It's going to be funny, and all the people on Cyclismus.
All right. Well, we've got to pack it up and scoot out of here.
Okay.
And we're rounding the home stretch on 2012 here. Just a few more shows until we roll it over to 2013.
Yeah, I'm already scheduling guests into 2013. How bizarre is that?
Yeah, it's coming up.
Yep.
Thanks for listening. Be safe, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.